This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Choose the most unusual matches. Choose the best of the WWF. Choose wrestling's biggest, smallest, and strongest. Choose Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Roddy Piper's greatest hits, and wrestling's bloopers, bleeps, and body slams. Choose George the Animal Steel. Choose the Ken Patera story. Choose the life and times of Captain Lou Albano. Choose the Hulkamania series. Choose the Ultimate Warrior. And choose Macho Man Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth. Choose WWF World Tour, Smack and Whack'em, and UK Rampages 91, 92 and 93. Choose a journey back in time. Choose seeing your video. It's time for everyone to dust off the VCR and plug it back into the television set as we take a trip into the Colosseum Home Video Vault with your host, Rory McNamara.
And joining me in the attic today is another first-time guest. He is somebody you might well have heard talk wrestling elsewhere. And yes, even after 3 months of prep, that is the best I could come up with. Andy is the host of the Random Wrestling Review podcast. Ben Spindler, welcome to Senior Video.
Oh, thanks very much for that welcome. And I didn't realise we were here to talk about wrestling. I thought this was going to be my dream of an EastEnders podcast, a retro EastEnders podcast. I was looking forward to it.
Is there a gap in the market for that, I wonder?
I think there is. I'm a massive EastEnders fan from the past, and I'm going to confess something to you now. For the last 4 years, Drama have been showing from the beginning EastEnders.
Oh,
I have watched it all the way through. They've shown 2 episodes a week, and so we are now 13 years into the soap, and I've been absolutely loving it.
So where are we at the moment? So that's going to be 98, 99?
Yeah, 98 it is. Middle of 98. Early 98, I suppose, yeah.
I think it was the Sanjay days I finally stopped watching EastEnders, so...
We've still got Sanjay and Geeta.
Still knocking around, is he? Okay, that's
good. Yeah, yeah. He's towards the end, though. He's about to leave in the next sort of 6 months. But, yeah, so that is my dream. So I thought that's what we were here to do. And to be honest, we probably already had, like, I don't know, about 75% of the people who started to listen to this already log off and go, I ain't listen to that rubbish. But
for those try and get them back, at least.
Well, exactly. For those who are staying here... We will be talking about wrestling, apparently.
Yeah, well, I'll see if I can get the EastEnders one onto the pop feed in the next couple of months. Anyway, this is the wrestling feed after all, so shall we try and stick with it best we can?
We'll do our best.
Let's try and bring it back by giving you your first perk as a first-time guest on this show, Mr. Spindler. And this is the part where I just sit back and let you talk about, oh yes, wrestling, where it all started for you, the length of your fandom, your favourite things, your least favourite things, the current state of play for you of pro wrestling in August 2021 as we record this, anything you want to say as an introduction for the very few people, I am sure, who have not previously made your acquaintance. Ben, over to you.
So I've been, yeah, a fan for about 27 years now, I guess. 1994, I got into pro wrestling. And I got into it via, first of all, well, actually, probably the year before that, I got into it via a kid at school who on the last day of term brought in wrestling figures to school in a big old Tesco bag. And I just loved it instantly. I loved those figures. I thought they were fantastic. But it was about a year later when somebody then brought in a WWF magazine into school. And I just, again, it just took me away. There was something about it. I can't even explain it now. Just completely took my imagination away, and I was in then pretty much for life. And over the course of the last 27 years, there have been peaks and troughs of my fandom. I think the first trough would have been mid 96 through to about the end of 97, and then back in 98, 99, 2000, all the way through those years, 2001. Stopped watching in 2002 because I went to university and didn't have a TV. Came back to where I live in Bristol in about 2006, picked it up again, but again it was on and off. Went to a couple of WrestleManias, and then in mid 2010s, I started working for WrestleTalk TV. Appeared on Challenge for about a year on the weekly show, talking about all kinds of stuff, pro wrestling, And then I did and interviewed the likes of Earl Hebner and Drew McIntyre and Samoa Joe and Matt Hardy, Vince Russo, Buff Bagwell, various other people. And then stopped doing that because I couldn't make enough money from it to live. So that coincided with me taking a big break from wrestling. And I think the end of last year, I reached a nadir of fandom, I guess, where I felt like probably I was leaving it behind completely. I just didn't, there was nothing going on that was interesting me. But for some reason, one of the co-hosts of my current podcast, The Random Wrestling Review, they just messaged myself and this other guy that was also the other co-host of The Random Wrestling Review and said, oh, I'm watching Rumble 95 and, you know, God, it's really, this is really amazing, or this is really rubbish. I can't remember exactly what he said. And I just sort of, I have no idea why, I just said, how do you fancy just recording a podcast about it? And they were like, yeah, all right, then let's do that. And so we did it. And we've been doing it ever since. We're now 30 odd episodes in. We review an episode every week. We review a wrestling show every week at random. Not that random, because we tried to keep them as close to the time in the year as the show took place. But we're about, 35 episodes in, a pay-per-view every single week. And it tends to be a bit of a car crash a lot of the time. And I say that in the best positive, most positive possible way. I like to think of it as a mix between the Totally Football Show, which obviously is a podcast about football, but about wrestling, but mixed with the BBC Two sitcom Bottom. And that is about as close as I can come to describing that podcast. So yeah, I've been in out a lot throughout my entire life. It feels now, say 27 years is certainly the majority of it. I'm as old as WrestleMania. And that's the way we kind of see our wrestling fandom. I think that's strange. I think that's probably where most people are with their wrestling fandom as well, is that wrestling almost for them began with the first WrestleMania. And the knowledge before that point is quite low. And that's where I think for the last 4 or 5 years I've been exploring is the periods before WrestleMania, the first WrestleMania. So I've kind of got into that stuff as well. So bit of everything. Mainly North American wrestling, have watched a lot of different independent stuff, a lot of different Japanese stuff, Mexican stuff, all kinds of different things. But I think my upbringing was on WWF, WWE, and to be honest, they're still the go-to. In terms of today, well, we were just talking about this before, Rory, before we started recording. I mean, I, until about 2 months ago, was completely out of anything that was happening the here and now. But I have become a fully fledged AEW fan over the last couple of months. And I find it to be almost exactly what I'm looking for from a wrestling show at the moment, which is not something I thought I would see 27 years into watching pro wrestling. So I'm pretty happy at the moment. I think I'm probably reaching a peak of fandom once more, which is strange to be in that position. I've got to be honest.
And we've got Royal Rumble 95 to thank for it.
Well, Royal Rumble 94. Hang on, what do you mean? Well, we've got Royal Rumble 95 to thank for the podcast.
Yes.
Starting. Sorry.
I wanted to make it worked for you and it didn't work for a Pamela Anderson joke, but you trampled all over it in the first 10 minutes.
I'm apologies. Apologies. Yes, for the podcast, Royal Rumble 95, absolutely. That's where it came from. I have no idea why he was watching it and I have no idea why that was where we started, but that's where we started.
IRS, wasn't it? We all know the answer.
Yeah, so IRS has become a little bit of a cult hero of ours over the period of time we've been doing it. But, I think what's been really interesting going back is watching stuff that I probably would have wanted to watch. But the funny thing is, we call ourselves the Random Wrestling Review. I'm really bad at watching things at random. I can't do it. I got a little bit of a spectrum thing, I think, where, like, you know, I think on the autism spectrum a little bit, very, very slight, but where I really struggle to do things randomly. If I, for example, if I want to watch wrestling and I think back, oh, I'm going to go through and watch something. So I remember thinking, oh, I could watch from the first episode of Nitro, for example, and I could watch Nitro and Raw, like throughout the Monday Night Wars. And then I thought, yeah, but if I'm going to do that, I may as well start episode one of Monday Night Raw. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I might as well start at the beginning of pay-per-views in 1985, and I was like, but then I wouldn't see the stuff in between, so should I also add? I basically I can't do it. I need to have somebody or something guiding me through watching stuff. And so I've seen you on Twitter a lot of the time. You are able to just sort of switch it up a lot and go, oh, I'm just going to watch this now, and then I'm just going to watch that. And of course, you've got the wrestling 20 years ago stuff, so you're obviously on that timeline constantly, but you're also watching random stuff. I really struggle to do that. It's only since we've done the podcast where I can kind of just come up with a really random schedule, which is still not quite random, that it works for me.
My network watching is very, very arbitrary indeed. It's rare that I know what I'm going to watch until I've fired the network up. Mm-hmm. A very strange occasion a couple of weeks ago, rather prescient now, where I just decided I wanted to watch SummerSlam 90. This was when I was still at work, a few hours before I got home, and et cetera, et cetera. You know where I'm going with that one. Otherwise, it's fire up the network, and yes, I'm going to go to this section, that section, and that section of that section, and we'll go from there. I just have the perspicacity for it. I don't know why.
Well, this is why, you know, I said about 3 or 4 years ago, I started a project which was every single match on the WWE Network in chronological order. Because I can't do it randomly. So I was like, fuck it. The best place for me to start is right at the beginning. Right at the very, very beginning of the WWE Network. And so I watched the match, which is Luthez against, I always forget his name. There's a guy, no, I can't remember, it's gone. But there's a match from 1952, I think it is, the first match. And I watched that, and then I watched everything. And I did it for about 1,000 matches. I got up to the end of 82, having watched about 200 episodes of the worst wrestling show in history, which is WWF's All-Star Wrestling show, which is so boring. But I've watched every single one that's on the network. I've watched every single one. And they are, as I said, they're really dull, but I went through it because I was trying to do this whole project. And as I said, I got to the end of 82, just about to go into 83, and I haven't returned back to it. I might do again in the future, but of course the podcast gets in the way now. Whereas I think if the podcast wasn't going, I would have definitely gone back to it and continued that journey. But yeah, as I say, it's a bit of a random one. I really struggle to just pick things at random, and I wish I could, because it would save me doing things like watching every show on the network.
But you did pick our video today. I'm going to say now, not at random. I'm going to give you some credit here, Mr. Spindler, and say it was a pick you thought very, very long and hard about.
So we're looking at Paul Bearer's Hits from the Crypt. I almost said Paul McCartney's Hits then, which is
All the Best. This is the name of his
All the Best. That's right. Yeah. That's an entirely different thing. Paul Bearer's Hits from the Crypt, released in what? Middle of 94, I assume?
December 1994, apparently.
December. Interesting. I picked this for a couple of reasons. The first one was that, as I said, I started watching in 94. My first show I watched was either Rumble 94, SummerSlam 94, or WrestleMania 10. I don't know for definite which one it was anymore. I can't remember. I think it was the Rumble 94, but I tell people it was WrestleMania 10 because that means that my favorite ever match was also the first match I ever saw. Oh, but yes. I think in truth, it was actually the Rumble 94 that was my first show. And so this was bang smack in the middle of you know, when I first got into it, and I know 94 really well from the perspective of the pay-per-views. But I listened to your podcast, this very show, the last time you did it, and you said on there that there are certain parts of the history that you only know through the pay-per-views.
Correct.
That's kind of how I am with 94, even though that's where I started, because we didn't have Sky or cable for that matter. So I largely watched wrestling through VHS tapes that people either let me borrow or I bought. So I have watched nearly all the pay-per-views. Well, I have watched now, but at the time I'd watched nearly all the pay-per-views of this era, but not seen anything from TV. So in a way, this VHS was kind of like me fulfilling kind of a dream, which was to be able to see some of the other stuff that wasn't on the pay-per-views. So that was really cool. And also, I remember seeing this advertised in WWF magazine. I vividly remember it being there, and not remembering what was on it or even necessarily thinking I want to buy it, but I remember it being advertised. And as somebody who's, I think it would be wrong of me to not give a lot of credit to my wrestling fandom to magazines in general. Like 94 through to about 2001, my reading of WWF magazine, Raw magazine, PWI, Power Slam was intense, to the point where I think there are some editions of Power Slam that I probably read cover to cover like 4 or 5 times. So Yeah, that felt like a good thing to do, was just to watch something that I remember being advertised in those magazines from back then.
Yeah, I've never seen. Have you seen this videotape before?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, first time for me as well. Like so much about this project. 94, I think I mentioned this on here before, but we could do it again. Reminiscing about 1994. It became my era. I didn't start watching wrestling at all until 1996. But most of the videos I was able to pick up, mainly off the pay-per-views, were from the 93-94 era. And it was as if I have lived through it. But first time I'd ever seen this videotape. First time I'd seen most of the matches on here. There are a couple from Raw that I did come across when I did a 1994 Raw Chrono Watch about 3 or 4 years ago. But otherwise, a lot of this is new to me. But shall we throw it to Paul Bearer himself to introduce it?
I think. Yeah.
So then, those 1994 paint box graphics, and yes, you know the ones, they start us off, soundtracked by what was at this point Undertaker's old music. The Death March itself, no less, plus an awful screen wipe into the banner text for today's video. It's meant to look scary, I suppose in many ways they were successful. Paul then emerges from a corridor in the bowels of a theatre, I think, anyway, just go with it, to introduce the tape. He picked the matches just for us, and he went through thousands of them too. Wrapping stiffies in outsized bandages doesn't look quite so bad now, does it? Until I discover the first match he picked was Jeff Jarrett versus Lex Luger from April 1994, and suddenly the cold hard slab looks rather inviting. But let's get to it nevertheless. Our commentary team for this one are Stan Lane and Gorilla Monsoon. The latter makes sure to get in a jab at Jarrett's dad, who is now south of the Mason-Dixon line, never to be seen again. Ooh. Never mind the fact he could have been running the company if any boy hadn't been able to beat the rap 2 months later. You know who is in charge here, though, as both commentators reel off a list of everything good about Lex's physique. You also know this is 1994, because Jarrett has gone for the full Mr. Motivator post Walk of Shame garb today. Ask your mum about Mr. Motivator. Without actually saying, it's both Stan and Gorilla call Luger lazy, so the bloom is well off the rose at this point. Match goes about 15 minutes until Luger wins with the rack, having done near to bugger all for the previous 14. Ben, what did you make of our opener here?
Well, let me say that this is probably the worst match on this video, this first match. I think probably just because it was so bloody long and Lex Luger doesn't do anything for nearly the entire match. And yeah, I noticed how they were really kind of quite stinging towards Lex. It felt like they were kind of, they'd already given up on him and now it was just, let's take the mick out of him instead of treat him as something that's really important and special, certainly in terms of the commentary. I assume these commentary spots were done in a studio months and months after the match took place.
Yes.
This is weird for me. I've never really watched any of these tape collections. I don't know why. The only one I have watched is WrestleFest 93, and I think that's quite long. I think it's like 2.5 hours or something. And I found it really dull, and I was worried when I watched this first match that it was going to be the same. But one thing I did to try and keep myself interested was guess when the match took place. As we went through, and I wasn't, as I said earlier on, I wasn't entirely aware of the exact date from when it was released. So that might have actually made it harder to guess when they were. I guessed that this was recorded in July of 94. It was recorded in April of 94. I later found out. But it's just really boring. It's just not very interesting. And I've said before how, first of all, Lex Luger is one of my least favorite wrestlers to watch in the ring. And Jarrett is not, I'm not a big fan of either, so it wasn't really for me this.
Very long 15 minutes as well. I was looking at my phone during most of this, I must be honest. And if you're doing that during the opening match, you're asking for trouble. Well, I was doing something reasonably constructive on my phone. I was scrolling through the history of WWE.com, as I so often do when watching the videos and matches for this project, so I can have the tips to hand. And thank you to the guys for their sterling work. In fact, I'm talking about that rather than this match. I should probably tell you everything. Jeff Jarrett, in many ways, is one of the most incredible, in a very literal sense, incredible pro wrestling careers anybody could ever have. There are books that could be written about this man. I am not nominating to be the scribe for saying, but one day somebody is going to. And I quite wouldn't necessarily mind having a shifty at it myself, really. Maybe in an unguarded moment or two. Luger, on the other hand, yeah, he was done at this point. He was done the previous summer, if let's be perfectly honest about this. Vince's cold feet at Auburn Hills in August 1993. That was it. There was never any coming back from that. But the commentators were really, and I mean really, going to town on this one. They were talking about how poor his offense looked. In 1994, you just did not do that at all. I mean, commentators weren't even meant to pick up on offense other than Gorilla and how well or not a abdominal stretch is applied, but that's by the by. Mm. For somebody who was supposedly still number two babyface at this point, I'm going to say, for them, for doing even post-production commentary, say it was done in July or whenever, to be burying him that badly and that obviously. The fact that Jarrett was, always has been, and always will be Jeff Jarrett. And to use the old Red Dwarf line, that is his crime and it is also his punishment. Thank you, Crichton, from the episode Justice. 15 minutes of this one and I wanted to move on rather quickly. Luckily, I moved on to this second match. Hopping back a little in time, and to the best of my knowledge, this one isn't available anywhere else. Our second contest on senior video between Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels. This one dates from February 1994 and is quite the giveaway for what was a dark match. Picture quality is a little ropey on the hard camera for this one, so they might have to work extra hard to maintain my attention. And that they do, including an early attempt at a Razor's Edge on the floor. Michaels then controls for a while and hears Stan Lane on commentary. Razor does not know the meaning of the word give it up. The word give it up. Oh, dear Stan. I really hope he didn't have a 7-year-old daughter at this point or anything. Oh, dear. But you know what I do like? Razor's diving flying knee. That's what I like. His offense was his strongest suit, I think. I don't like the double count out we get shortly afterwards, as this one was really starting to get cooking at the time. Thankfully, nor does anybody else, as Razor successfully lobbies to get the match restarted, as everybody wants to know who the real champ is. More damn fine action ensues until Razor hits the edge, but with the ref down, so Diesel is able to even the score off that. HBK can't steal a win, though, because Marty Jannetty, who I wrote in capitals for some reason, breaks it up. Diesel tries to get back involved, but misses Marty with a punch. Nails Shawn instead, and Ramon rolls up Michaels to retain. And yes, they'd adapt and swap the roles around a bit for this finish of their match in August. There I say, Mr. Spindler, this one was a bit, as we say, more like it.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And you talked about the fact that they kind of swapped some of the roles around for their SummerSlam 94 match. I actually think also there's a lot of spots in here, a lot of exchanges in here that they use at WrestleMania 10 in their ladder match, which I watched probably about 15 times. And so it was like quite fun to just watch them play out those same spots again. But obviously they're preparing for that match here as opposed to kind of redoing them, which was cool. I guess that this one was January 94, so I was much closer with this one. But that was mainly because Shawn Michaels still had his bogus Intercontinental title belt with him. Yeah, this is really good. I really, you know, these two really did wrestle well against one another. They had great chemistry. Razor Ramon is a far better in-ring competitor, I think, than he's generally given credit for. I think maybe he gets cast into a shadow sometimes by the careers of his peers, especially in the clique, and as a consequence no one really pays much attention to the fact that he was a really genuinely very good worker, good talker on the mic, great in the ring, had a great character which was super over during 94 in particular. And I really liked it. It was really fun. Didn't really understand why Jannetty was allowed to push Michael off of Razor Ramon and not get Razor Ramon disqualified. quite happy that it didn't result in a disqualification, because, you know, the temptation for them to go with the DQ in a match such as this, which will be released on a VHS at some point in the future, was probably quite high. But it was a bit strange that the referee allowed it. But yeah, really, really enjoyable stuff this was. Yeah, really liked it.
Yeah, me too. Excellent. Match of the tape, I'm going to say that nice and early. We've already announced two of our four awards, but hey, never mind. Yeah, really, really good stuff. Probably a step down from the match they would have on Raw a few months later, which we talked about when we did the Hits from the Heartbreak Kid tape a couple of months ago. But it's not still far behind, even so. And it did feel like a little bit of a tryout for the WrestleMania 10 match. You're quite right. And I really loved, I'm going to say it again, Razor's offense in this match. I do think that is the best thing about him. His offense looked crisp. It looks firm. It's believable. He knows what to do at the right time. I did intentionally make notice of his flying knee because nobody ever talks about it. So I wanted to get that one on the record. It was a really good back and forth. Michael still hadn't quite got it together at this point, in my opinion. It would come, and how. Big hints here, it must be said. He's getting better in 1994. He has lost that little bit of extra ballast that he had through a loss of 1993. Let's be as kind as I can calling it that. And he's just a few months away from becoming Shawn Michaels' all-time super worker. It's almost there at this point, and it's fascinating to watch. Really good timing from the two of them. Their spots were bang on. It's hard hitting as well for two people who you'd like to think quite liked each other. I'm sure they did. And what was a giveaway at the end of a taping, teasing a razor's edge on the floor after 4 or 5 minutes. That's pretty something hefty for a match of this not especially great magnitude, but I certainly wasn't complaining. A little bit of a mess at the finish. I don't know if we really needed the double down, double DQ, but at least it didn't end that way. A double count, I should say. I did fear that this being a Coliseum video, that's where they were going. But Razor, man of the people that he is, didn't want it to end that way. And the ending could have gone wrong, especially with Marty Jannetty being involved. Thank you very much. But they did get it right, and ending it with a roll-up, probably all you need here. You don't need Shawn taking a razor's edge at this point, especially with what's to come the next month. And this was really excellent. Not their very best work together, but stands on the pantheon, in my opinion. I do wish it could have got one more straight up pay-per-view match between them, but obviously very few pay-per-views at this point. And what we did get at WrestleMania 10, SummerSlam 95, I admit I'm just being greedy at this point. typical internet wrestling fan, you know, offered him to give us a straight up wrestling match, only two of the greatest ladder matches of all time. But I'd like to think I'm allowed to do that. I'm probably not, but excellent match here, and well worth going out of your way to fire up the tape to watch this one, especially as I said, I don't think this one's available on anywhere else. Maybe, and I'm guessing here because I don't actually own it, the Shawn Michaels unreleased DVD set perhaps, but if it's not there, it's not anywhere else from here. But worth $9.99 of anybody's money, in my opinion. Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels from February 1994. Very strong stuff. Right, we go back to Paul Bearer. He invites us into a room where apparently W.C. Fields, Mae West and Harry Houdini used as a dressing room. Well, W.C. Fields and Mae West ghosts probably haunting each other to this day. They did not like each other, folks. And then completely unawkwardly throws us the Bam Bam Bigelow versus Mabel. I was about to prepare a sigh moment for this match, but that was before I heard Gorilla hooing and yeah-ing to Mabel's music. And oh yes, you had better believe I'm going to play that one in for you. There, I didn't make it up, or did I fever dream it? The respective seconds for the guys here do a lot of the work, but I must also draw attention to Mabel's noble attempt at a dropkick. This one does end in a double count out after a clothesline over the top then.
Yeah, this one, what can I say? This is much better than it should have been.
Yes.
It's really quite enjoyable. I was really shocked by it. I thought, I really thought, okay, this is going to be, gonna be 3-4 minutes and then they'll be done. You know, Bigelow will win it because they would treat Mabel as a bit of a jobber, a bit of a joke during this period. I mean, he lost to Jeff Jarrett at SummerSlam, so that should tell you everything you need to know about Mabel at the time. And yet they don't. They go for a little bit longer than that, and it's really rather enjoyable given that we've got Mabel, who, best be fair to him, can't really do very much. Except he can fall forward really well into a roll and make it look like he's done a really cool spinning heel kick. But that's about it.
Noticed that too, did you?
That's about the one thing he can do. And also, as much as I like Bam Bam Bigelow, and I do really like Bam Bam Bigelow, it has to be said, his punches are terrible. He doesn't, there's a slew of them in the middle of the match where he like is hitting Meebor. And it's so visibly clear that not only is he not hitting him, but also that if he was hitting him, then the impact of them would be so feeble as to not stop anything in his tracks. It's ridiculous. But it's still really quite fun. And yeah, I give him a lot of credit for that. I guess that this one, that it was March 94. That was my guess for when this took place. I don't know why I guessed that March 94, actually. Interesting one, that one. Yeah, and then I thought there was one thing I wanted to mention. Stan Lane makes a Ray Charles's blind joke during this one, which was a little bit wearing thin, you know, with that particular type of joke. And also, by this period, surely is now Stevie Wonder that joke is made about, not Ray Charles. So that was a bit strange, but in general, I really enjoyed another really enjoyable match. Compare this to Lex Luger versus Jeff Jarrett.
Absolutely.
And you think there's no way that this is going to be better. It is far, far better than Lex Luger versus Jeff Jarrett.
With the best of intentions, they went out there and they did stuff in this match, which does help when you're watching pro wrestling, I find. Actually doing things.
Yeah.
you're halfway there. And I give them a lot of credit for that. This was okay. This really was okay. Not my style at all. What we call hoss matches in the game, not my go-to, really, it must be said. But this was a decent example. It was just about the right length. They kept it simple enough, but it was some good back and forth. Bam Bam's punches aside, which now you mention it, yeah, you're quite right. I thought it was as stiff as it needed to be. It was okay. I'm not going to go over the top on this one because there's very little to go over the top with. But this could have been the proverbial train wreck, and they just about managed to keep it on the rails. It's very easy to go into these matches with preconceptions. Understandably so, I think. Things are easy in life for a reason. But this was probably, I'm going to put this into the pleasant surprise category. I was ready to hate this one, and I didn't. As you rightly say, the opening match did skew my judgment a little bit, but this was fine. Wouldn't go as far to call it recommended, but if you do carry on watching after the Michaels Razor match, expect to be pleasantly surprised, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, the other thing, I find it quite funny that you called it a bit of a hoss battle, because it's really not. I mean, it doesn't do justice to the idea of a hoss battle.
I think, and I'll freely admit this, hoss is becoming a bit of a catch-all phrase now for anybody who weighs over 270.
Yeah, that's it. It's a bit like saying Haystacks Calhoun's matches were hoss battles. They were just a big old fat guy having a match. This isn't really a hoss battle. This is just two big guys sort of lying on top of each other, but doing it quite gracefully.
It's Jim Ross's fault for calling everybody a hoss in his piece for WWF.com in 1999, and it stuck. Well, I first got onto the internet in 1999, so there you go. That's my explanation, and I'm going to stick to it. Jim Ross's fault, everybody, as ever. After explaining the entire backstory for it, and you know what, I appreciated that, Paul Bearer then takes us to Raw in May 1994, and the Quebecers defending the tag team titles versus the Head Shrinkers. So, Ben, this of course means Vince on commentary, much to your delight, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I love a bit of Vince. Love a bit of Vince's commentary. It's just, for me, a very comfortable place, which I know very well. And the thing that, I mean, this is really good. This is, again, really enjoyable little match, this. It's a shame that obviously you've got the breaks because it's Raw. So yeah, You've got the breaks for Raw. But that's by the by. Everything else about it I really like. And what it made me think about, actually, was the nature of these videotapes. And I imagine that there are some people out there who bought this videotape when it came out. And think now about this title switch as being really significant, because they had it on a VHS and saw it.
Yeah,
and it felt like an event. It felt like a happening. It felt like something when you were watching it. The crowd were really hot. They popped big for the victory for the Head Shrinkers. And as I say, I think the person who would have bought this tape will, even 2 years later, have thought, oh, that was a really important match, that Headshrinkers Quebecers match, the title change hands. And I think there's two reasons for that. First of all, obviously, they would have had it on the videotape and just would have given it this sort of sheen as if it was really important. But also, the title changes did seem to mean more in the past. I can name practically all of the tag team champions in order from about 1985 through to about 1999 or something like that. But I can't even remember who the two tag team champions are now. I just found that really interesting that this could have really meant something to a lot of people, and understandably so, because it's a really decent match. We've got a crowded cast of characters on the outside. You've got Lou Albano and Afa and Johnny Polo, obviously Raven. And, I was really shocked by this. I was like, we're going to get one of those really poor, you know, especially after listening to this show last month and thinking, oh my God, like the matches they had to go through there. Jim Neidhart against the Barbarian, was it, for like 15 minutes? Crikey. I was like, there's no way I can sit through that. But this was shaping up really well.
Yeah, Lacey knows how to pick them. We're already well ahead of that, so don't worry. Although the next match to come might have something to say. But anyway, let's talk about this one for a little while before we get there. Just a couple of notes on the commentary too. Randy Savage responding to the USA chant by saying that it's obviously for American Samoa.
That was a great save. That was a great save. I was so impressed with that. I was like, you know, like I was just about to be like, oh, these stupid fans chanting USA. There's no Americans. And then Savage saved it. I was well impressed.
We disagree on that one. I've written, nah, leave it, mate, after that note. So there we go. Again, not for the first time on this tape. A noble effort from the boy Savage there. I should say in this match, we did get the heels walk off and then getting the they must return to the ring before the 10 count or else they lose the titles deal.
Yeah.
And Fatu eventually got the pin for the Headshrinkers with a splash on Jack. I really like the Quebecers around this time period. They were a good tag team. They had some good tag team moves, and I do miss that. They were tag team specialists, as Gorilla himself would also say. Worked really, really well together at this period and their WCW stuff a couple of years down the line as well. And I loved the Headshrinkers at the time, going back and watching 1994 stuff. They were one of my favourites, and matches like this reminded me why. They just felt very, very different, despite their obvious mid-90s cartoon presentation. They didn't feel like a WWF unit, really. I mean, obviously where they came from, their stuff with the Samoan SWAT team, etc., and NWA, WCW, of course. But they felt planted into the World Wrestling Federation, and were all the better for it. And I love Fatu at this point, and I think, for me, probably the high point of his career. I know most of our listeners would probably disagree with that, but I think 93-94 Fatu certainly provided his best in-ring work around about this time period. And this was just hot. The crowd would probably fit into the room I'm recording this show in right now, given the venue there. But never mind, they were hot for it. And as you say, it was a title change that felt important. And we'd be able to add this one to the lineage of tag team champions from 1985 to 1999 without even pausing for breath.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right there, Ben. I could barely even tell you who the world champions are now, let alone the tag team.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. You know what, though, I'm glad you said some of that stuff, because it reminded me the thing that Fatu used to do all the time in this period was that incredible bump he used to take for the clotheslines when he just turned himself inside out. Was just phenomenal. And also, you're right, the Quebecers were great. They were a really good tag team. That match where they have with the Hearts at Royal Rumble 94 is a stunner. And they are just really good. And you know what? It's such a shame that Jacques decided to retire. He obviously then came out of retirement later on, but he decided to retire, which is what ultimately prompted the split and then Jacques to move away, because Pierre had obviously gone to be Jean-Pierre Lafitte in WWF in the following year. Mm-hmm. Because they could have, I think they should just been able to carry on. Probably, you know, I don't know what happened as well to Samu, because he kind of left later in 94 as well, and he was replaced by Barbarian in the Headshrinkers, which kind of was the end for them as well. But both tag teams really good. I don't, like, it's one of those things where I know WWF have got this horrible habit of just almost just I don't know, dispensing with tag teams for no reason at all, breaking them up for no reason at all kinds of weird stuff. But you've got the beginnings of why the tag team division became such a terrible situation over the next few years by the fact that these two tag teams no longer existed by the end of 94.
Yeah, 94 was a great, fucking great period for tag teams. There you go, I said it. It's yet another reason I return to this time period far more often than I otherwise should, but the tag teams are definitely one of the reasons. And this was a really fine match, another one worth checking out. So then, let's go to a WrestleMania 10 rematch. Rubs hands with glee. Which one is it going to... It's just obviously Earthquake versus Adam Bomb. Come on. For the record, this episode of Raw dates from April the 4th, 1994. The untold story.
In fairness, this is the one match from WrestleMania 10 that absolutely warrants a rematch.
Very true. That's very, very true. I think also on this edition of Raw, we did get the 5-on-5 that was cut because nobody could decide on who was going to be the captain on the heel team.
Yeah, because they ran
I'm sorry, that's a great... I'm sorry, that is a great kayfabe reason. call it my 94 bias, if you will. Kayfabe, that is a great reason.
That is definitely a bias. I mean, like, when have 8-man tag teams, 10-man tag teams ever had captains? Like, what?
Stop bringing... I can bring in logic into this, for goodness sake. Anyway, this match here. Earthquake wins a match 8 times as long, I think, as their previous encounter. And, of course, I've written somehow 8 times worse, which is probably a little unfair. Or is it?
It's very unfair.
Now he's putting the bias.
This is fine. This is not, it's not good. But it's like, if I'm going to have a 6 or 7 minute match between two big guys from the WWF in 1994, Earthquake and Adam Bomb are fine. And it's all right. It's okay. It's not, as I said, it's not great, but it's fine. And Earthquake does the arm stuck in the rope spot. Adam Bomb does his little thing over the top rope, which I can never remember the name of, sort of clothesline where he springboards himself over the top.
Yes, that's good. Yes, I'll give you that.
Earthquake does a lovely looking belly to belly suplex and then hits... What is the name of Earthquake's move? Because, funnily enough, we, in the episode of my podcast that hasn't come out yet, we talk about this move, Earthquake's move, and I don't know what it's called. I suggest it might be called the Tremors, and during this match, Gorilla Monsoon and Vince McMahon suggest it's the big one. What is it called?
I was going to say the Tremors, but I think that's wrong.
I think it's wrong. I don't know what it is, though. It's
he would always talk about the Tremors, but that was just him wobbling back and forward during his interviews. Do you know I don't know?
Yeah, I don't think anyone does. I think it's a mystery. It's just the big old sit on the face spot.
That brings us to another discussion now. Is there anybody else we can think of who had a regular use finisher that didn't have a name? Anybody else you can think of now?
I don't know.
Or was Earthquake in a field of his own on this one?
Well, he's not. I guess there was because Shawn Michaels, you know that suplex he used to do? I know that's
teardrop got a name. Suplex.
Yeah, I know that's got a name. But I never used to know the name of it. And to be honest, it kind of completely fell out of use. Like, he didn't just... It didn't make a big deal. Like, usually when a wrestler gets a new finisher, they continue to use the old one, but it just doesn't have as much impact. He never used it after he got the super kick properly. I don't know why that came to mind, because it's not the category you're asking about. But I just think that... I'm trying to answer the question without actually answering the question, because I think you're right. I have no idea if there's another one who hasn't got a name. Yeah, but this one, I genuinely don't know the name of it.
A knowledgeable bunch on the P2BN network. If anybody is going to know, it will be one of them. So don't leave us hanging on this one, please, guys. And don't stand on ceremony. Find us and tell us, okay? I'm going to struggle to sleep until I find out what Earthquake's finisher was called. I wish you never brought that up. Now, I've never thought about that, and now you're absolutely right. That's the worst combination of things.
Sorry about that. Sorry for being right. Sorry for bringing something up, but we don't know the answer to. And it doesn't exactly improve the credibility of two people podcasting constantly and expecting people to listen to them when we can't come up with the answer ourselves.
Yeah, we're tying our hands behind our back here, aren't we? We should know this stuff, Ben, shouldn't we?
We should. I guess that this was from April 94, and I believe...
On.
Yeah, and I believe that, well, the match was recorded in March, but it was from Raw in April.
It aired on the 4th. I'm definitely giving you that. And the fact we've talked about other people's finishes rather than me going back to talk about the match myself should tell you all you need to know. But it wasn't the opener, so there we go. That's the one thing it has going for it. Otherwise, this will be an easy pick in about 25 minutes' time. But as it is, I don't think it's going to get there. Yeah, it existed, didn't it? And as you rightly say, they did get 4 minutes to serve up what they served up rather than the 30 seconds at WrestleMania 10. And I've seen WrestleMania 10 so many times, I have seen Earthquake Adam Bomb's 30-second epic. I've never skipped it. There you go. I've never skipped that match from WrestleMania 10. There you go.
But they were doing something. I haven't seen it, but I know they did have the Earthquake Yokozuna Super match, didn't they, at some point on television. And
a little bit after that, I think.
Yeah, and they were building to it. Like they obviously brought Earthquake back simply to do it. I remember there was a piece in WWF magazine around about May of that year where they bigged up Earthquake's history of being a sumo wrestler and a grand champion. So they were obviously really keen on doing this sumo wrestling match. I think that's the only reason they brought him back and gave him a push.
I think that might be on one of these tapes, or maybe when I was flicking through the 94 Raws, I saw it on there in the chapter points. I'll get back to you. And if it is on one of the videotapes, then I'll be in touch. No, I'm not going to let anybody else take that from you now, Ben. No, you brought it up.
Good. No, thank you for that. Reserve that one for me. Yeah.
Stake your claim whenever you can. Highly sought after some of these ones. What's our next one? Brett, are we glad to see you? We jump ahead a little here to April the 18th, 1994. Vince calls the ovation for the Hitman deserved, and he's dead right. Sadly here, our champ's auditory senses are gravely damaged by the sound of 280 pounds of shit hitting the fan. Quang. An oldie but a goodie there from Scott Keith. It's said by many, including yours truly, that Hart could be prone to dogging it in certain TV matches, but I see no evidence of that here, however. He's giving as much as he's getting, and infinitely more besides. Quang gets in his turnbuckle spinning heel kick as we hear from Owen Hart on the phone. Ah, 1994. On the worldwide WrestleMania Revenge Tour, that's punchy, he is going to beat Bret again. Sadly, he doesn't get to say much more on the phone, though, over Vince's 1-2 ands. You take what you can. Bret goes on to win with the sharpshooter clean in the middle. Ben.
Well, Owen should know quite damn well to just keep his mouth shut whilst Vince is trying to count the covers, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. No, I was a bit disappointed by this. I'll be honest. Mm. I was like, oh, here's Bret Hart. Great. Against Quang. Great. He's decent. That's fine. This could be a fun 10-minute match. It was all right. It wasn't bad, but I think I was just expecting a little bit more from it. I guess if you compare Earthquake versus Adam Bomb to this, you're going to pick this. But when you compare your expectations of those matches, the Earthquake Adam Bomb far outstripped it, if you see what I mean. And my guess for this one was May 94, so I wasn't too far off. And yeah, there wasn't a lot to say about it. I just found it a little bit blah, a little bit disappointing. And it's kind of one of those weird things where, again, Bret seemed to be given, and he did the same when he was Intercontinental Champion, he just seemed to get given a lot of these really low-level heels to fight. Mm. I remember when he was World Champion the first time, and they have that interview with him at Survivor Series 92, where he's talking about the people he's faced, and he's like talking about Skinner and like Berserker, and you're like, oh, come on, like give him someone decent to face for the title. And because these are on house shows as well, so you expect them to give him someone decent, you know, because you're not giving away the match. It's on house show. It's on a house show after all. So yeah, and here he is again, Quang. Like, I mean, Sammy Vega is a decent worker, but Quang was not a particularly high profile opponent for him. So yeah, a little bit disappointed here.
Yeah, episode 2 of Senior Video that I did with Ben Locke. We watched Bret versus Kamala.
Yeah.
You get it? You see what we're on about here? Bret's world title defenses against, like, Papa Shango on the last Saturday night's main event and what have you. And he was just saddled with all of these people. He was just too good for the company at these points, I'm afraid. But I say he did bring the effort in this one, even if the aptitude wasn't quite there. Quang was not able to give him anything here. You can tell, because I've seen so many Bret matches, because he's one of the greatest of all time. Of course I have, you know. I know what side my bread is buttered. But you can tell when you're watching a Bret match now, when he's starting to get a little bit frustrated, you just see the eyebrow going and the lips start to twitch after about 7 or 8 minutes. And that was happening in this one. It did seem like a very go-home finish to me in this one as well. So if he didn't fancy it anymore, can't say I necessarily blame him. We did get a lot of Vince 1-2s. Even better than that, can you imagine? Even better than that. He called the green mist green slime. Well, it's obviously not slime. It never has been slime. It never will be slime. but Vince McMahon could call it green slime as often as he likes, as far as I'm concerned.
You know what? The more they keep slime away from wrestling, the better. It was, I can't remember, it must have been early 2014 or late 2014, somewhere 2014 at some point. Dean Ambrose bringing out slime on Raw was, for me, one of the worst things I've ever seen on Raw. Because it's like, the thing is, I guess probably it's an association that British people make more than anybody else, but it's all about Noel's house party. Like, it's just...
The dunk tank.
Exactly. It's so childish that you're like, oh, get this off the television. This is absolutely rubbish. And for a character like Dean Ambrose to be mucking around with it, you're like, come on, mate. What's that about?
Yeah, there's just something very Saturday morning kids TV, or in that case, Saturday evening kids TV about slime. And it's the sort of thing you expect to happen to Philip Schofield.
It's exactly it. That's exactly it. No, it's just not for me. So, you know, everyone should be thankful that at this point they were keeping slime firmly away from wrestling. And this was in fact mist, not slime.
But if Vince calls it slime, it's slime. No argument. Especially 1994 Vince. Another outing for Oscar's rap, but Gorilla keeps shtum this time. Back to the Coliseum video exclusives here from Rochester, New York, as Men on the Mission and Doink square off via the rum combination of the Quebecers and Jeff Jarrett. Stan is getting far too comfortable as this, as he steals Monsoon's I Hope They Reinforce the Ring line. Ooh. He then immediately undoes everything by saying Doink has a fake clown nose. Then we get this exchange. Lane, do men hug each other in Canada? Monsoon, they walk hand in hand too. They don't miss a tricks, do they? I think this is Ray Apollo as Doink. It's definitely not Matt Bourne. He actually takes some rather strong heat in this one before finally getting a tag. He chases Double J off, and then Mo, not Oscar, Gorilla, pushes Mabel onto Jacques for the win. Yes, you heard me. What do we got, Ben?
Yeah, so this is a bit of the tape where things are starting to fall away a little bit for me. It was okay. I found all the way through Gorilla Monsoon's commentary strange because, as you said earlier on about the Luger stuff, he's kind of buried him a bit. And some of the things he's saying, it feels like only Gorilla Monsoon could get away with in a lot of cases. I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here, but you don't hear much about Gorilla Monsoon from people. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's lots of people talking up.
Yeah,
you know, when you hear them in like interviews and you hear them in shoot promos and whatever else, there's lots of people talking about all these great wrestlers from the past, these great personalities from the past. Given Gorilla Monsoon is Gorilla Monsoon, you don't hear a lot of people talking about him, and I wonder why sometimes. Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's deep dive material, isn't it?
Mm.
That's a really interesting one. You're right, you know, you don't, do you? You really don't.
You don't.
I don't feel it was just taken as read. As about, but it really, it's never been read.
No, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, we are removed quite significantly from his time as such an important part of WWF. But all the same, there's still plenty of guys around that you thought you'd have heard more about, but you just don't. And I don't know why that is. During this match, he references Jacques Knight in the Slammer from SummerSlam 91. Which I think he kind of tries to link in with the holding hands Canadian.
Yes, that's where it came from, yeah.
So, obviously they're getting at something here, and I don't intend to follow it through in terms of what it is that they're trying to achieve with it. And yeah, it's okay. You say Doink is pretty much in the ring for the whole match, apart from the end, and he's got Jeff Jarrett in, and I'm just not that big fan of Jeff Jarrett. So, the tape is, as I say, starting to dip in quality for me at this point. Yeah.
A lot of these videos are very, very front-loaded, I've discovered in the course of the last year and a half, with good reason, you might say. Any guesses for the date and time for this match?
So I guessed that June 94. I know it's not, but I guess when I guessed it was.
You've been pretty on so far. So I don't actually have it in front. I couldn't find out.
It's April. It's April.
Oh, it was April again. Okay, right.
Yeah, I think it's the same night as the Luger Jarrett match, almost. Yeah, I think it's the same night or the next night or something. It's very, very close to it.
Yes, same taping. There we go.
Yeah. So, they were in for a treat that night with those two matches. And the other match from that show was the Mabel Bam Bam Bigelow one.
Oh, my goodness me.
they really were on something. I think the other thing that dips the quality here is that they've selected wrestlers we've seen. That's the problem for me. We've seen Mabel,
yes.
We've seen mm-hmm. Jarrett, we've seen the Quebecers. Like, if it had been a rubbish match, but with different people, I'd have been, yeah, all right, then fine. It's great to see, I don't know, 1-2-3 kid against someone or Bob Holly against someone or whatever. But as it is, you're kind of like, oh, well, could have given us something different.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I watched this video in 2-hour-long sittings rather than taking it in for the full 2-hour-5 in one go, because 2 Jeff Jarrett matches in one night. I've had that nightmare many times. It's not one I especially want to live, you know. So, yeah, it's a fixture of a lot of these tapes where we get doubling up and tripling up. I think it was Super Tape 1 where I had 3 Typhoon matches.
That's the stuff dreams are made of right there.
Yeah, I very much made this bed myself, didn't I? And it's,
the piper is being paid. How do you think they choose these matches? Because it's obviously, as much as I love the idea that Paul Bearer has literally watched thousands of matches to
pick really these that's true.
Specific ones,
yes.
Obviously that's not what's happened, and they've just thrown a collection of matches together. And when, as a consequence of the fact that you've obviously got people doubling up, quite a few people doubling up towards the end of this tape, I kind of start to think, did they literally put no effort into this in terms of choosing what they did? They just almost literally at random put their finger on a piece of paper and said, yeah, right, they're in. Because I would have thought at the very least, when you're combining these tapes, obviously it's not like you're giving us the best matches of the time, because you've got Earthquake and Adam Bomb and Mabel versus Bigelow and Luger versus Jarrett. So wouldn't you at the very least just try and make it so that you didn't have the same wrestler on more than once?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I wonder if, and I don't know if this is true, somebody who was around at the time might be able to tell me, somebody who attended a lot of house shows, I know they're out there, that they created the videos before they shot the matches.
Right.
They knew full well, I mean, this is just conjecture here, they knew full well in December 1994 they were going to release a videotape called Paul Bearer Hits from the Crypt. And they had that planned from, I don't know, late 1993 or something. And they chose beforehand, for better or worse, right, this match from the February 94 Springfield taping, and when we get to April 1994 at Rochester, those two matches from there, and they already just pre-picked them. Because there's no real rhyme or reason here. Again, that doesn't answer the question of why they double or sometimes triple up on so many wrestlers. I can't really answer that one. But there had to be some kind of selection process going on here.
Well, yeah, especially as you've got the Hetchering versus Quebecers, right?
Yeah.
And you've picked that from Raw. Now, you could have picked anything from Raw. So why have you picked that when you know you've already got Quebecers match lined up from that taping? That's mm-hmm. where I'm like, why haven't they just recorded? Because obviously every time they do a challenge taping or a superstars taping, they're recording 3 or 4 episodes in a row. They know it's dull because they're all bloody squash matches. So on the dark matches, they have like some decent stuff for the people who've come and paid their money. Why didn't they just record all of them and at the end of like a 6-month period go, right, what have we got? What can we split up and put on a video? Like, that's what I would do. I just think that makes much more sense.
I think, say, history of WWE.com has again been invaluable for discovering this sort of thing. That it doesn't look as though there were many they left out. If they were taping a match to go on a Coliseum tape, it ended up on a Coliseum tape. They just welded it in there with no form of rhyme or reason whatsoever. And it really does show, especially when we get to the second half of a lot of these videos. I suppose I should say something about this match. I thought Doink, again, I think was Ray Apollo, took some pretty good heat. Not that he had much choice because he was in the ring for 12 to 14 minutes. But otherwise, not a whole lot to write home about, as they say. Right, home straight, and in the gods, Bearer presents a match he promised us, and it's a very interesting team indeed. No, not you, Yokozuna and Crush, but Lex Luger and Randy Savage. This dates from Springfield, Massachusetts, on February the 2nd, 1994, the same taping as the Razor Shawn match we saw earlier. This was the final match of the session, and the crowd enthusiasm, or lack of, definitely bears that out. That, and as stated earlier, Luger just isn't who the fans want. Sadly, I'd say Macho Man is offering pretty minimum effort in this one. He's in no mood to sell the nerve pinch. Lex is back in, but nah, it's not going to happen. Even the finish is rather listless as Savage bops Crush in the head with the salt bucket and Luger gets an apologetic pinfall. Ben, you can tell by the tone of my voice that this was not what I was hoping for. Randy Savage. This was, I've been maybe wait for this and maybe he should have just stayed Babe Ruth after all.
Yeah, no, I think I mean, I have to agree. Is, you know, what I realized when I, because you mentioned the history of WWE.com, I looked at that prior to the recording today just to see when the actual dates of these things were after I'd guessed the dates. And the Lex Luger Jeff Jarrett match that opens his tape was meant to be Lex Luger versus Yokozuna originally. He replaced him in the match. Yokozuna was replaced by Jeff Jarrett. So effectively what we would have had was two Lex Luger versus Yokozuna matches on this tape, if that had happened as it was meant to. And given that that was probably one of the worst matches in WrestleMania history, WrestleMania 10, it's incredible that they would think to add more of those things. But yes, yeah, I mean, you're right. Even Randy Savage is by this point not interested. I don't, it's one of those great mysteries, isn't it? The whole Randy Savage, you know, Vince McMahon deciding that Savage was no longer going to wrestle, given that we did see in sort of later in that decade that he could still go. And if they gave him some meaningful stuff to do, even if it was kind of a sort of, I don't know, a signpost on the way to the top kind of guy where he faced all the heels who they were trying to push to the top, that might have made sense. And yet he kind of refused to use him a lot through that period. I just a very odd situation. But from this, you can kind of understand why potentially, because he really wasn't very good in this match. My guess was January 94. It happened in February. I think the reason I guessed at this, and this was really quite silly of me, is the layout of the arena that this is in looks like Madison Square Garden, other than the fact it's much smaller.
I thought the same when I first saw it.
Yeah, it looks like Madison Square because they come in, the entranceway is opposite the hard cam, which is a Madison Square Garden giveaway. And so I was kind of like, oh, is this Madison Square Garden? In which case it probably would have had to be January. So that's why I went for January, but it's not. It is actually, when you look at it, a much smaller building than MSG.
I think going forward, because you've done sterling work on this one, Ben, every other guest now going forward is going to have to, whether they like it or not, guess the date of the matches.
No, you've gone
above and beyond here. They need to do the same.
I just find it fascinating. That's why I did it. I'm a massive, you know, I'm a big statistics guy. I'm a big data guy. I really find this sort of stuff really interesting, when things happened. And I'm also, so my actual job is a business analyst, so I'm all about how things work and how, why they're done that way and who's done what. And so I really was trying to look at when these matches took place to see again why they picked them. What there must have been. I refuse to believe it's just this one. There's got to be something about
it. I hope it isn't that, but I'm struggling to hold that hope.
Yeah, but no, I mean, this, going back to this match, it's just not very good.
It's not at all, and just seeing Savage like this was disappointing, and maybe Vince was onto something after all. He did show signs of life. At the singles match with Yokozuna that was actually taken just a couple of days before this, that aired on Raw at the end of February 94, that was actually quite good. I do like the Falls Can Occur Anywhere match, as it is known, the crush at WrestleMania 10 more than some people. But otherwise, yeah, if this was how he was doing it on house shows and tapings, probably best for all concerned. This was a poor Macho Man Randy Savage performance. There can't be too many of those, but I was treated to one here. And obviously the other three people he was in the ring with weren't the people who were going to assist any. So this one was a huge disappointment. There was probably just enough strength of personality to be very charitable to carry this one out of the doldrums. But this was a real letdown for me.
Very, very, very charitable.
I pretty much have to be to make these shows listenable.
And if you want some more bad Savage performances, WCW 99 is the place to go.
Oh, Lordy, yes. Thanks for the reminder. In my other life, yes. They're all out there, folks. I mean, just sliding month to month through Randy Savage matches in 1999. Oh, my goodness me. Right, let's draw to a close with, and I knew this was coming, an Undertaker match. So, and they do this just to annoy me. We go back in time to 1993. listen to the Undertaker He Buries Them Alive volume of these shows for where I really rant about these matches not being put in chronological order. I won't do it again here, I promise. He is against Crush, and again, we are in Springfield, Massachusetts. Commentators here are Gorilla and Johnny Polo. As I am duty-bound to point out whenever Bill Alfonso is the referee, Bill Alfonso is the referee. Taker really is on full-on zombie mode here, and so is Crush. Mm-hmm. Crush goes for a tombstone after 6-7 minutes, and there's only one way that is going to end. And after 2 hours and 5 minutes, there's just time for us to cut back to Paul in the theatre, and like any good mortician, he thanks us for joining him. Ben, closing with an Undertaker match. Well, what do you know?
Yeah, so I, to be honest, I didn't know this was coming. I surely should have guessed. But I also was very much of the mindset that this was a... Because you said that they released it in December, but I was thinking this was probably a middle-of-the-year release, because most of these matches were from early 94, so that's just how my yeah. mind worked. And so I was thinking, probably haven't got an Undertaker match here, because he was on a break for after Royal Rumble. So I was like, I wasn't expecting there to be one, but then, of course, it did make perfect sense. And, that, and therefore, I guessed that this was December 93. But when I checked, I couldn't find when this match was from. Did you have the date?
I did have. I don't have it in front of me. I want to say it was November 93 when I checked a few days ago.
Right,
I think it was just after or just before Survivor Series.
That would make sense. I didn't know this was coming, and thankfully that therefore I wasn't dreading it, which I would have been doing had I been aware that it was coming up. The Undertaker here has never looked more like Mick Hucknall than he ever will than during this one. Johnny Polo's on commentary as well, so we've got that as a sort of added, I don't know, call it if you will, a bonus. This, you're right, Bill Alfonso referees this because Polo says something about derogatory about the fact that at least it's not Joey Morella as the referee, who of course is Gorilla Monsoon's son. And they kind of have a little in-joke there, which I, again, probably wouldn't have got away with on the television show, but it's nice that they did it here. There was one thing that I thought was pretty impressive, which was when Crush did a military press slam on The Undertaker.
Yes.
Which was quite, I've never seen really, I don't think I've ever seen him take a military press slam, to be honest. I didn't see any of his Warrior matches. If he did one of them at that point, maybe that happened, I don't know. And I made the note of the Bill Alfonso being referee, mainly because then I was like, well, hang on, we've had Mike Yoda and Tim White, but we've also had Earl, we've had Joey Morella, we've had Bill Alfonso, and we've had Danny Davis. We've had the who's who of interesting referees during this show, during this video tape. And that shows you where my mind was going to during the match rather than actually watching it. So I was thinking about the referees we'd seen. So not the best way to end. And plus, two Crush matches in a row. That mm-hmm. is a new depth. Like, Crush is terrible. And, like, awful. You've got two matches in a row here. And one of them is with The Undertaker, which at this stage in his career was quite a painful experience, even though when I first started watching wrestling, The Undertaker was my favourite.
I think he was all of ours for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I've learned a bit about him since then, you know. I am, of course, as I'm sure you all know, listeners, I'm on the official charts website right now, going through Simply Red singles, but they're not very punsome. I'm struggling to come up with anything here. You know, a new flame, maybe, if we jump ahead to 1998. I'm struggling with my Simply Red Undertaker puns. You've caught me on the hop there, I'm afraid. Your mirror.
Well, if you don't know me by now, you'll not realize that I would have come up with something like that. But these aren't exactly the biggest stars.
Oh my word. Will somebody please come to my aid? There we go.
but don't forget, we're in this together.
So. Oh my god. Official Euro 96 song, everyone.
It was crazy, isn't it?
I'm still going through the list for your babies, thrill me.
I told you I'd take you on
remember
a different...
first time, maybe. There we are.
Basically, we started this podcast talking about EastEnders. We're ending it talking about Simply Red. That is the kind of content you can expect from me.
And there go the final 25% of us.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, this was a match where The Undertaker beat Crush in November 1993. That's all I've really got to say about it. Crush is fucking terrible. Let's not mince words here. But he's just so ubiquitous on these tapes. I know you did this on the Random Wrestling. You know, you kept a tally of how many times you see each wrestler. I do think Crush, he's got to be up there in the 18 months I've been doing this.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me because, like, they just seem to be really high on him for a very long time. I guess
they wanted him to be something.
They did. I guess he was just a big guy when Vince just loves his big guys and thought, yeah, this guy's going to be something. I'm going to put him in and make something of him. Never did because he's rubbish.
It's interesting that he, through about 4 or 5 major gimmick changes, he got to keep his name too. I don't think there are many other people who did that.
No, you're probably right. Taker is an interesting one as well for me because, like, I think this is I don't know how he stayed over. You know, I did joke a little bit about this when you put the VHS picture, the cover of the VHS on Twitter today. but I genuinely, like, I guess he just, this was a case where WWF just really came up with a really great gimmick. And regardless of the fact that his matches were poor to awful for nearly all this period, for what, 4 or 5 years, he just was always over. Power of presentation, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, undeniably. There's no oddsing it at all. He managed to stay over as well with... It's quite... Now, can you imagine a character even remotely like this coming out today in anything other than being put as anything other than a total joke?
No, I can't.
Let alone even getting anywhere close to being that over.
No, it's crazy. It's really crazy. The funny thing is because I said I was a big fan of The Undertaker when I first watched wrestling, and when, as I said, the first thing I saw was Rumble 94, which is where he gets beaten up by 10 people and his spirit raises up to heaven and all that stuff. And, you know, obviously it's rubbish, but I absolutely loved it when I first saw it. I thought it was fantastic. And it kind of, sometimes you have to go back to the primordial years of your wrestling interest to understand why some of this works, because when you look at it from the perspective of someone who's watched it for so long and kind of has a refinement of taste of what they think is good and what is bad and et cetera, you are blinded sometimes to what will be successful, I think. And this is probably one of those cases.
Glad we did get an Undertaker match on here, and those who've listened to me for a very long time on various projects might be a bit surprised to hear me say that, but it's because I was expecting it and they made me wait until the very end. And because Crush couldn't provide anything in the way of action, there was very little to actually hate here, despite my best efforts. Crush didn't do anything for 5 minutes. The press slam was nice. He attempted a tombstone and I knew we were going home. So that's it. And as I stated in my notes, as so often on these videos, we cut to the end very, very, very quickly. At least Paul Bearer got to do a little piece before we closed out. 2 hours and 5 minutes. I want to say that's very long for one of these tapes. It's probably the longest non-event, and I mean not an event, not that this was a non-event, of course, green, that I've done in the course of this project. And I don't think, looking through the network right now, there are many longer, but we'll see what comes up next. Right, so then, Ben, I think it's time to dish out some awards, don't you?
Yeah, let's do it.
We've done the first two of them already, but for the sake of completion, what is our rewind, our best match or moments?
Best matches, well, it's got to be Razor Ramon versus Shawn Michaels. I do think, though, that the Headshrinkers Quebecers deserves a little mention as well, because that was good and also actually significant, whereas the Razor Shawn Michaels match has not been seen by very many people.
True. I do think that Razor and Shawn had the most quality, but I'm very glad that a big title change, I think, two good tag teams made it onto this tape as well. But yes, otherwise Razor and Shawn, for the second time in 3 months, take our rewind honours. What about our fast forward, our worst match or moment?
It's so obviously Lex Luger versus Jeff Jarrett. It hurts.
So obvious. Oh, it hurts. Believe me, it hurts.
It's crazy. Like, it's crazy how bad this is. I mean, I'm not saying, as I said, I'm not saying expected anything from it, but they gave them so long. Why did they give them so long? And it's like, it's bad. It's easily the worst thing on the show.
I think they were just trying to test our resolve by giving us 15 minutes at the start of the tape. And the test it most certainly was. Worst match by a mile. Right then, this is going to be an interesting one. What's our pause moment, our most striking visual of the tape?
Wow, okay. The most striking visual. Ooh, let me think about this for just a second. Now, I'm going to I'm going to jump over Mabel's attempt at a spinning heel kick for a second, because that is impressive. I think, to be honest, probably the old, I think it is probably the military press slam that crushed us on Undertaker.
Wow, okay.
Because I just didn't, I've never seen it. I've just never seen him held up there before. And he doesn't just hold him up there. He does the old military presses with him, doesn't he? Sort of push-ups with him in his arms. So not a good match at all, but that was quite a shock for me. I thought of another one. Apologies. Getting loads of them in now. In the Headshrinkers Quebecers match, the missed cannonball the Quebecers do.
Ah, yes.
The moment where there's a camera change, the angle of the camera changes just as the Quebecers are mid-flight. So they're almost vertical to one another, if you like. And it looks very, very high up. So that probably is it for me.
A good camera cut and WWF presentation. Well, what do you know? well played, Kerwin. I'm actually going to go for something outside of the ring for this. I'm going for the spotlight on Paul Bearer in the final two segments. I just thought that was really something. I thought Paul Bearer was actually a very good host for this tape, whether or not he went through thousands of matches. And please say that he did. The fact that he actually gave us some backstory, I thought was great. He seemed as into it as he could possibly be. And just that spotlight shining on his face when he was sat up there in the gods, I thought was really nice. So I've gone for that. Yes, it was a bit of a struggle this month. But final thoughts on this tape and the big award. Which one of the four are you going to go for here then, Ben? Was this tape a buy, as in one of the very best? Was it a rent, as in pretty good? Was it a bargain bin, as in okay? Or as a wipe, as in nope?
Well, it depends if we're grading on a scale, doesn't it? Because if we are saying, if I'm grading on the scale...
Most of these videos, we are grading on a pretty significant scale, yes. Or we should be.
Yes. So in that case, I would give it a definite rent, definitely. Probably a high-end rent, I'd imagine. I don't imagine there are too many, you know, old-school video collections that are as good as this. I might be wrong. You're going to be much better placed to say that. As I said, I haven't seen too many of them. But the ones I have seen and the match lists I've seen for some of these things and heard about are absolutely awful. There isn't a lot that's bad here. And so I'd say this has got to be a relatively decent level of quality. So I'm going for rent.
Me too. I think this one's pretty solidly in the second tier. You've got a good mix of stuff on here. You've got a really high quality match early on. So you've got a big title change. You've got a Bret match, which is far from one of his finest, even TV matches, but it's still 10 minutes of Bret Hart. You've got a decent mix of competitors until you get to the second half. They've got Paul Bearer holding it together pretty well. Yes, you've got some undeniable dross on here, but you expect that, especially in the course of 2 hours and 5 minutes of any form of 1994 presentation. You take the rough with the smooth. This is very solidly went for me. Certainly not the best tape we've watched, but far from the worst. So Ben, a very solid first pick, my friend.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of it, to be honest. I don't think I'm going to be able to match it again. But who knows? Maybe at some point in the future I'll be able to come back and go one better and get it into that buy category. Although, how many of you actually had that have got into that category?
Very few buys, I must say. Yeah, very few collective buys. I think Roddy Piper's Greatest Hits, I think, is the only one everybody gave a buy to, myself and Scott last year.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's the standard to set, and it's heel Roddy Piper in the mid-80s. It's a big ask, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what was that, you know, legendary run by a legendary wrestler. Yes, that's going to be hard to match.
I will let you flick through the home video classic section for the next few months if you've got nothing else better to do. And just let's just see if we can get it up to that double buy. It's possible. Ben, you did let us know what else you do in the podcasting world at the beginning of this show, but anything else you want to plug while we're here, go right ahead.
Yeah, no, I just give another plug to the podcast. So the Random Wrestling Review, we review a wrestling pay-per-view or major wrestling show every week. From a random point in time, tends to be of the period of the year, from the period of the year that we are recording, but also is all over the place. So we've recorded stuff from 1985 through to this year, in fact, and all points in between WWE, NXT, ECW, WCW. We're even looking at doing some other stuff later in the year that's going to be a little bit more out of the out of the realms of the ordinary. And it's a bit of a crazy thing. You can catch us at RWRPodUK on Twitter, and that will probably do. I don't think I've got too much else to plug.
Looking forward to your SummerSlam 90 show, which will be released tomorrow after you record this one.
Absolutely.
Especially as I sat down and watched that event myself 3 weeks ago, because I did. So I'm hoping for some high marks on SummerSlam 90. It's one I've got an odd affinity for. Let's put it that way.
Interesting.
Okay, I think I know what that means, but we'll find out. this time tomorrow I will know. What else have I got going on? Here on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Network, you can hear me every month as part of the Special Relations, Ben Locke and Callum McDougall, where we just talk about random bollocks for 2.5 hours, really. Bit of modern day wrestling, bit of retro stuff, live watch along. The shows are very rarely planned, as I'm sure you probably worked out, but they're always a lot of fun. So do check that one out. The latest show will have been out for about a week after you hear this, I reckon. And of course, you can hear me on the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast, where, as the name suggests, we watch pro wrestling from 20 years ago in the timeline as if it is actually happening. As this show goes out, you should be getting our September 2001 program any day now as well. Unforgiven and all of that. Kurt Angle's title win. Yay. Lots of other stuff in September 2001 to talk about as well, which is less edifying, but needs must. Also, listen out for the Indie Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast on the same feed. The guys don't do that one in timeline, but they jump around and pick out all sorts of weird and wonderful matches that took place in independent wrestling during the respective month 20 years ago. Some good, some very good, some bad, some very, very bad, but always a very interesting listen. So check that one out on our feed as well. And that's about it for this edition. Ben, just one more time, thank you for joining me, good sir.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a treat.
We'll definitely have you on again in the future. Start picking now. But everybody else, I will catch you again next month for another edition of Seen Your Video. But for now, Paul Bearer hits from the crypt. I have Seen Your Video. Catch you all next month.